Did you know that there was a Kennedy sibling who spent most of her life in Wisconsin? I didn't find that out after living here for a few years, and I'm sure I'm not alone. We'll have her story coming up in this week's Behind the Headlines podcast. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks for joining me. Other stories we'll talk about this week include the new fangled credit cards that have perks for consumers, but are a bit of a headache for retailers. We'll also take a look at Governor Walker's approval ratings since dropping out of the campaign, as well as a review of the Bucks training camp so far. But first, Journal Sentinel publisher Betsy Brunner recently journeyed to Poland. Her mission was one many can relate to. She wanted to discover more about her family. But when she arrived, she found few traces of not only her ancestors, but of any Jewish population in the town. When Poland was invaded by the Nazis in 1939, the Jewish population of the country was more than 3 million people. Today, Poland's Jewish population is less than 4,000 people. Here's Betsy with more.
I joined a mission that was sponsored by the Greater Jewish Foundation here in Milwaukee. And that was a group of about 40 people, mostly Jewish, not all totally. And they were all interested in returning to Poland, either because of family ties or just historical interest to see what had happened to what was once a very large Jewish community there.
What was your personal interest in going?
My family came from an area right outside Krakow where we stayed. My grandfather emigrated in 1903 and left many generations of family members behind, and I had some curiosity to see whatever happened to them.
Were you able to find anything out?
Yeah, I traveled to the little town he came from. Like most of Poland, which used to have millions of Jewish people and families back before World War II, there was nothing left. And so in this little village, all of the Jewish homes had been taken over, the cemeteries had been vandalized, the synagogue was burned down, and there really was no trace of the people that had lived there for centuries before, including my relatives.
Oh my gosh. How did, you know, in the story you specifically talk about a field that during World War II was used as a mass grave, and to this day they're finding pockets of these. How did that experience and the experience of trying to track down your family and your history affect you?
I was one of those people who thought I had read every book on World War II. I had seen every movie and every newsreel. Until you get there for real, until you see the towns the people lived in, the roads they walked, the places where they worshipped, you really can't put it all together. And I know for me, it wasn't real until I was in the place, seeing where people had lived and seeing where they disappeared.
And what message would you like your readers to take away from this story?
You know, all of us have roots. All of us have families. All of us have some curiosity, whether it's in Ireland, whether it's in Central Europe, whether it's in England, whether it's in Africa or Japan or anywhere. We want to know where we came from, and everyone ought to have that experience. I was very lucky to go with a great group of people and just have a very meaningful opportunity to do that. And I would hope everybody gets a chance to discover their roots the same way.
How could readers take a trip like this? Are they available for people who are in the mission, or are there other organizations that people could connect with?
I know in this case that the Greater Jewish Foundation here in Milwaukee is considering another trip like the one I took. And I would imagine churches, ancestral groups, family connections. There's a lot of interest in genealogy now, and I would imagine anyone who wants to travel back to the land of their ancestors could do so fairly easily and learn what I learned.
Betsy has two stories in this Sunday's edition. I would highly suggest reading both of them. They're moving, haunting tales. I need to give you a bit of a history lesson before we proceed to the next story, so bear with me here. Rosemary Kennedy lived in Wisconsin for most of her life. If you don't know about her, she was the third child of Rose and Joseph Kennedy and the sister of President John F. Kennedy. Rose was born with some sort of learning disability. It's hard to know what exactly her diagnosis would be today, but she functioned and read at about the fourth grade level. Her father, Joseph, was notoriously harsh on his children. He had great political ambitions for them, particularly for his sons. He pushed all of them, kind of living vicariously through them, and wanted them to obtain success despite the rampant anti-Irish sentiments at the time. Rosemary never caught up with her siblings, and when she began to act out as an adult, Joe took her to a doctor and had a lobotomy performed. He did so without telling his wife. The procedure, of course, caused a severe amount of damage. She went from functioning at a fourth grade level to having the bodily functions of a two-year-old. She needed to relearn even the most basic of tasks, including walking. Not wanting to damage his son's political careers, Joe eventually hid his daughter at St. Coletta's in Wisconsin. Books editor Jim Higgins read two novels about Rosemary Kennedy. First, Rosemary, the Hidden Kennedy Daughter by Kate Clifford Larson, and The Missing Kennedy, Rosemary Kennedy, The Secret Bonds of Four Women by Elizabeth Kaler Pentecoff. Here he is with more on the books.
In the 60s, her siblings slowly started to reconnect because they weren't really aware of what was going on with her. JFK made a surprise and private visit here in 1958 when he was ramping up for a run for the presidency, and they report that he was really shocked at the condition his sister was in. He had no idea. And Kate Clifford Larson really credits the siblings reconnecting with Rosie with the way they took up the cause of advocating for people with disabilities. You know, in American families, this was still considered kind of a shameful thing. But as JFK and their sister Eunice, who became one of the leaders of Special Olympics, you know, reconnected with Rosie, you know, they got out in front in, you know, talking about having a sister with disabilities, promoting legislation that improve services for people with disabilities, just really mainstreaming, the word we would use today, mainstreaming people with disabilities.
It's a very interesting story to me, just because we have the benefit of hindsight now.
Right.
You know, we know that lobotomies are extremely dangerous and detrimental procedures. They're no longer performed and haven't been for some time.
Right.
So to hear the history behind it, that's still an emotional story. How did the authors convey those emotions while trying to kind of dig through the history that was so hidden?
Kate Clifford Larson, who's also written a very well-received biography of Harriet Tubman, you know, she handles this as a biographer would, trying to explore the motivations, the reasons, the outcomes. The shock and disdain still really comes through. This was a crazy thing to do, and this was one of the richest men in America, you know, who did this to his daughter. And at least I think the argument the author makes, you know, it's really that this is a tragedy. You know, it's a tragedy where her needs conflicted with Joe's aspirations, and that's what led to this horrific result. She also takes Rosemary's mother to task some for really not fully owning up to the truth, that she finds Rose guilty of some dissembling about what she knew and when she knew it, and never just really coming out and owning, you know, the truth about their daughter and what happened to her.
This is an interesting slice of Wisconsin history because I don't think it's that known. So as a Wisconsin resident, had you known this much about it, or when did you find out about this?
Oh, no. I mean, people had known. I mean, I've been a newspaper reporter here since the early 80s. People knew that Rosemary lived at St. Coletta, but both the Kennedy family and St. Coletta were very strict about her privacy. You know, she wasn't made available to reporters. She made very few public appearances. They were very protective of her privacy. So I think that's about all most of us knew, is that she was a Kennedy sister. She had some disabilities, and she lived there. And so much of this book is brand new to me.
To read Jim's review, pick up Sunday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can also find it online at tapmilwaukee.com. You've probably seen headlines about them this week. There's a new kind of credit card hiding out in wallets. It has a chip in addition to a magnetic swipe. The chip is actually much more secure for consumers. Magnetic card swipes have information that can be reproduced and used to create a whole new card. With the chip, every transaction is identified by a single code, And that code is only used once, meaning that if a thief gets that information, they can't use it. But this new kind of card has a few downsides for retailers. Here's business reporter Rick Rimmel with more.
For retailers, it's a bit of a headache, really. For one thing, it's an expense to change to the systems that accommodate the chips. Target Corporation said they estimate they will spend $100 million to put in place all of the hardware and software. Now, Target has 1,700 stores across the country. They've actually been a leader in converting to the chip technology. Not surprising, given the big data breach that they endured a couple of years ago, and which, you know, really probably hurt their business. I'm quite sure that Target wants to project out to the public that we're concerned about security and we're actively doing something about it. So Target, as of like mid-August, I think, Target had chip readers in place at every one of its point-of-purchase terminals in every store in the country.
If you're a smaller business, how does this impact you?
I talked with Steinhoffel's, the furniture store, and they have 10 furniture stores and 7 or 8 mattress stores. And they're estimating a cost of like $115,000 for the hardware. And there are additional costs beyond that because you have to train people how to use it. And so it's definitely a six-figure expense. A twist on some of the smaller retailers is that they're kind of last in line to get these new systems certified by the credit card processors. So Steinhoffel's, it's going to be a few months before they have their systems in place and certified for use. And that's been an issue, apparently. And so, you know, there's the cost and the headache of going through all this, plus having to wait while, you know, the credit card processing companies, I would guess, are paying perhaps more attention to the Targets, Walmarts, Kohl's of the world.
And then as a business reporter, have you ever encountered a time when the businesses themselves were reluctant to talk to you about any of the figures that go into things like this? And if so, how did you maneuver that?
Well, they're often reluctant to talk about any financial information that they consider material. However, I don't know. I talked about numbers to Target, to Steinhoffel's, to Kessler's Diamonds, and they all offered something. So it wasn't that terribly difficult, I guess. One other thing I might say about the chips is that, you know, the transactions take a little longer with the chip card because you're not, instead of swiping your magnetic strip card through a slot, you're what they're calling a dipping. Your card into a machine. The machine holds it. You can't pull it out for a while. So I've done this with my ATM card at my bank, and at first I found it a little disconcerting that someone had grabbed my credit card or my ATM card and I couldn't get it back. Now, of course, you do get it back after several seconds, but the added time for each transaction, I've heard anywhere from a few seconds to as much as 20 seconds, one analyst said. Now, if indeed it is, say, even 10 or 12, 15 seconds longer for a transaction, you know, that potentially could create some delays. If not for that particular person who's doing the transaction, 10 seconds is nothing. But think if you had like 5 people in line at a checkout at a Walmart or something. It's like a backup on a freeway, sort of one car slows down and then everybody has to slow down. So, but I don't know. The best information I've heard, I think, is that it's just a few seconds. But I have heard as much as 20.
If you haven't gotten a new card yet and you're interested in learning more about them, pick up Sunday's edition of the Journal Sentinel or visit jsonline.com/business. What has Governor Walker's presidential bid meant back home? A recent Marquette University Law School poll has his approval rating at a mere 37%, with 60% of those surveyed saying they wouldn't support him running for a third term. Poll director Charles Franklin sat down with editor Greg Borowski during our weekly JS on Politics show to go over some of those numbers. Here's a bit of their chat.
All right, we're joined now by Charles Franklin, the director of the Marquette University Law School poll, to talk a little bit more about some of the numbers we found. First, Charles, let me ask you about Governor Walker and his approval ratings. We've seen a slide. What do you attribute that to, and can he turn it around?
Right. Well, the slide since April has been 41, then 39, then 37. So it's been a steady decline. It was 49% approval just before the election. So this is a decline. I think you've got a multiple whammy going. One was, of course, the budget, which was controversial. Voters didn't approve of a lot of things in the budget, both fiscal and some of the policy proposals. And then the governor was out of the state, not here defending it much. Then there was the race itself, and our polling has consistently shown 60% or more that wished he had not run. And that included a significant fraction of Republicans who wished he hadn't run. So this is the underlying story of
absence,
not just one thing, but multiple
didn't
things.
Didn't make the heart grow fonder, but do you think the governor is saying, well, he'll spend more time, that's what's going to heal things? Do you think that, is there a chance for him to turn it around if he's spending more time here?
I think there's no question that being here, delivering your message, is critical for rebuilding a relationship that has slipped a good bit. The open question is whether the issues that are currently before the state are likely to be good issues for him to rebuild. So the civil service changes, for example, as far as I can tell, was not his proposal, but now he comes back and he's the one supporting state senators' proposals rather than the other way around. The governor talks about big, bold ideas, and the question is what are going to be those big, bold ideas that he proposes rather than ones that come out of the state legislature, as with right to work, now with civil service reform, GAB changes. All of those things are legislative initiatives not coming from the governor. So what's he going to put his name and stamp on?
All right. Let's look now at the presidential race, because with him out of the race, that certainly shakes things up in the in the Wisconsin numbers. So we're going to start with numbers here on the Republican side. The top candidates only, we have Donald Trump at 20%, followed by Ben Carson, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush is in fifth at 7, Carla Fiorina fourth at 11. Where did the support that Walker had go?
It's like the cork came out of the bottle and Donald Trump fizzed up to the top. He gained 11 points. He was down at just 9% a month ago. But with Walker out up to 20, the 11 points is the biggest gain that we saw. Rubio gained 7 to also have a pretty big gain. We wondered how much the favorite son candidacy really mattered, and I think we get a nice bit of evidence here. Walker's support was 25% a month ago in the GOP, and according to our data, of voters who still would like him to run, which is about 28%, Trump gets 22% of those. So actually, among Walker supporters, Trump does slightly better than he does on average in the whole state.
If you're interested in catching the full show, you can find it online at jsonline.com/politics. That show is also available in podcast form on both iTunes and Stitcher Radio. In the debut of a new Journal Sentinel podcast on the Milwaukee Bucks, Beat writers Charles Gardner and Matt Velasquez talk about the team's opening of training camp last week in Madison, the addition of free agent center Greg Monroe, and the return of Jabari Parker, plus more.
You know, but as much of a fun change of pace trip as this is, it's still a business trip. This is training camp. This is a team that, you know, was kind of a surprise playoff team last year that retooled, made a big splash in free agency, especially with Greg Monroe, made some changes, and they have high expectations for this year. You know, so they're not going to treat training camp like an event or, you know, something to entertain fans or anything different like that. You know, talking to Monroe today at practice, he said, you know, this is an opportunity to get away. You know, usually players, you know, when they're at home in Milwaukee, they'll go home to their respective places, you know, after practice, and there's not an effort to build camaraderie, but here they're in the hotel together, they're hanging out together, they can go out, you know, in town or for, you know, for dinner or whatever together and spend that quality time, but they're really locked in on becoming a better team, on getting used to playing with one another, which, you know, they could do a little bit in informal practices and pick up games and whatever they did over the summer. But this is a chance to do it with coaching, do it when they're working on offensive and defensive sets. You're not just freelancing. You really are putting in, you know, the front work for getting the season off on a good start. And so they're really focused on that.
Well, correct. That was funny that Monroe today said, hey, we had shorter practices at Georgetown. They weren't this long after Jason Kidd went 3 hours today. And tomorrow there are two practices. And Thursday there are two practices. So it is business, as you said. And there was a lot of talk. I think there were fans in Madison would have liked to have seen an open practice. You and I received some emails about that. But there won't be one here. There's a lot of work for them to do. They're going to have one Saturday in Milwaukee. They will play a preseason game here on October 20th. But as you say, the bottom line is they're still doing a lot of work. And especially in that first week in training camp, that's when a lot of, as Monroe talked about today, the lingo, the play calls, some of this is put in. And it's an important time. You know, they scrimmage today. So there's a lot of work going on, and this is an important time in preparation. Already they'll have a preseason game 1 week from today, next Tuesday in Chicago against the Bulls.
And I can see where fans in Madison would be kind of bummed, you know, that they're not going to get a chance to see the team. You know, there has been a lot of talk over the summer that the Bucks are coming here for training camp. You know, that's something that they were buzzing about. And then, you know, there's no opportunity, there's no events, there's no, you know, access. And that's not an uncommon thing in the NBA during the first week of training camp for coaches to shut the doors. I mean, this is their first chance to get in there. They don't really open up, you know, for a lot of access. But as a fan, you see the team come in, and, you know, for all intents and purposes, it doesn't matter. You know, they're in your town, but there's no access. You can't go in and see them and kind of interact with the players unless you happen to go to the same restaurant they go to at night.
Jason was saying that maybe some of the players would be out and about at volleyball game or some events around the UW campus this week, and maybe they will be.
But nothing official.
But nothing official, correct.
And so that I can see where fans might be a little upset about that. You know, if you are a big fan, you do have the opportunity to go to Milwaukee on Saturday for their open practice and fan fest. But, you know, it's still a trip for someone who lives in Madison or a different part of the state. So in that regard, I think, you know, the Bucks kind of, you know, might rethink that in the future. I don't know if they will, but it's something to consider. If you're going to have training camp or have opportunities elsewhere, you know, fans are going to want to take advantage and interact with the team.
We'll see how the attendance is here on October 20th. That'll be interesting. There is a buzz about the team, I think, already, and it'll be interesting to see when they play the Timberwolves here on October 20th, how many fans show up.
You can listen to the entire podcast at jsonline.com/BucksPodcast. Also, look for it on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. And so ends this week's installment of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Behind the Headlines podcast. Thanks so much for joining me, and tune in next week as I walk you through some of our newsroom's biggest headlines.